Welcome to the M Files. You are listening to Valerie and Ella Mayers, Patty Woodfinkel, and John Woodward, mining the muse in the museum world. On this episode, we are speaking to James Taub, the history and engagement specialist at the National World War I Museum and Memorial. Thank you for joining us, James.
Anytime. Happy to be here.
Hi, James. How are you?
Oh, not too bad. Just getting ready for the interesting rush of holiday time visitors at the museum and putting up with all the interesting logistical challenges and opportunities too that comes with. So really excited and looking forward to an exciting new year of history and museums and engagement. So
that is awesome. I love this time of year. We always get the interesting visitors that are coming from out of town and just discovering the museums for the first time. So that's always a lot of fun. But my first question for you for the interview is, what is the strangest thing that has ever happened to you at a museum? Now, this could be a museum you were a visitor at, a museum you worked at, could have happened recently or years and years ago.
So I think in terms of really strange things, obviously museums bring out very interesting people and very interesting topics and objects. But I would have to go with an experience I had at a fantastic museum, which is the Titanic Center in Belfast in Northern Ireland. Because you're walking through and it's gorgeous and it overlooks the shipyard where they actually built the Titanic. And towards the end of it, they have a list of all of the passengers and crew who died on the Titanic. And I was there with a friend of mine in grad school who pointed out that her great-grandfather is listed on the names of those who died in the boiler room of the Titanic, and no one made it out of the sinking, which begs the question, how is she around? As it turns out, and as she later informed the museum staff, he was one of the workers who helped build the Titanic and was working in the boiler room when it went from Northern Ireland down to Southampton to pick up its passengers. However, the night before the ship set sail, he did what many young men in Great Britain would do, and went to the pub and missed the ship leaving. And since no one made it out of the boiler room, no one was there to say he had survived, so he just went home. And his name is on the memorial at the Titanic Center in Ireland, and I believe the family is still trying to get that corrected.
That is a great story. So, James, would you tell us more about yourself and how you became interested in museum work? How did you end up at the National World War I Museum?
So like many other folks in the field, it's been a wild and all over the place kind of journey. I've known I wanted to work with history, especially since I was about 5 years old. I saw the movie Gettysburg. I think I was obsessed with the mustaches and the beards on Civil War generals, which I try to recreate now. My best ability. But from there, I knew I wanted to work with history. But as a student going through high school and then through college, I also knew that I wasn't really the best academic. Let's put it that way. I totally enjoy reading and writing and contributing to the field. But spending my time, in the ivory tower wasn't really where I wanted to be. I'm much, much more of a kinetic learner. I love to be able to physically see things, be able to handle things. I took some amazing art history courses, some amazing just regular history courses, but the importance of the topics never hit home until you actually went to sites and saw where things happened or saw the objects and the artifacts that were associated with those times. So that's kind of what shifted me towards public history and towards museums especially. And I was extremely lucky, and I will name drop the person who I think I owe my career to. He's the curator of the museum for the National Park Service at Gettysburg. His name is Greg Goodell. And I was a young undergraduate in college, and he took me in as a volunteer and then as an intern, showed me how collections worked, showed me how preservation and acquisitions worked, and really got me started and passionate to be inside in museums there. And I was his intern for the National Park Service at Gettysburg for about a year. Before moving on to work in more education as an intern with the American Battlefields Trust in Washington, D.C., as well as then working in the museum at Fort Ticonderoga for their summer season up in upstate New York, which is gorgeous, and I highly advise anybody who gets the opportunity to head out there. They run it exactly like it's in the 18th century fort. I then went to grad school in the University of Glasgow in Scotland, where I got my degree in war studies. And growing up, I, of course, was obsessed, like a lot of young Americans, with the Civil War, with the Revolution, with World War II. And there was always that big gap of time. And I realized, traveling to Europe, seeing the First World War battlefields, and the World War I is really what I loved and what I wanted to study, in particular the European aspects of it. So I got my degree in war studies with focus on the First World War, came back and was the education coordinator for the United States World War I Centennial Commission, which was the federal government's commission to mark the anniversary, the 100th anniversary of World War I. And we reached several million students and hopefully got some folks thinking about the Great War. And through that, I made this incredible connection at the mecca of all things World War I studies in the U.S., our nation's museum and memorial here in Kansas City. So now I'm out here enjoying burnt ends, enjoying the awesome beer scene, and watching my cholesterol.
That's an amazing journey, honestly. And I wanted to jump in here because Val and I went to Glasgow this summer. We were at a conference in Edinburgh and took a day trip down to Glasgow to see the university there. It's a beautiful campus.
It's gorgeous.
Oh, yes. We are so jealous of the time that you got to spend there. We had one day, we were actually at a Natural History Museum Collections conference. So a lot of our time was revolving around that. But what a dynamic city. What a place for history.
It is. Glasgow is my favorite city in the world. I love Kansas City, but Glasgow will always be my second home. Great friends still over there. And again, with the museum scene, it's one of those hidden gems of people always say, you make sure you go to Edinburgh, make sure you go to London. But collections like the Hunterian, they're both the natural history, their science collection, as well as the People's Museum over in the East End. There's just, I volunteered while I was in grad school at the Royal Highland Fusiliers Museum on Stuckey Hall Street, which is one of the local regiments from the British Army. And it is just, it's just a hidden gem in so many opportunities. And the ability that that school and that town gave me to, on my own, go out and explore and talk to folks in museums and get some volunteer time in, learn about opinions of how museums run outside of the United States, really is a huge thing that has really helped me and really motivated me as well.
Well, and the conversations that museums are having there too, Mungo Campbell, the director of the Hunterian, it's a really engaging exhibit on, you know, curating discomfort and the idea of the creation of knowledge. And that was just so exciting to see.
It's really interesting how museums over there, as well as here in the U.S., are dealing with that, those sort of discomforting topics. We're talking about it here. I'm very passionate about telling stories from colonial subjects during the Great War, and specifically I'm focusing on the French Empire right now, and talking about how North African Muslims, troops from Senegal, troops from Indochina experienced the war, as well as we recently had a traveling exhibition from the New York Historical Society called Black Citizenship in the Age of Jim Crow, which we additionally curated to include a little bit more World War I content. And it's just that goes to the heart of why I love working at museums and why museums are important. I want people to be uncomfortable and I want them to learn from it.
You know, before we got on started recording the interview, we talked a little bit about Kansas City and our mutual connection. But and I mentioned that I've been to the National World War I Museum before several years ago. But can you tell our audience more about the museum and memorial and how much of it is a landmark to the Kansas City area?
Yeah, well, I'll start by sort of saying that the museum, as our president and CEO, Matt Naylor, says, is we're Kansas City's front door. So we have, I would say, a majority of the engagement and wedding photos take place on our courtyard because we have a gorgeous view of downtown Kansas City. So we're at the heart of being part of the Kansas City community, and we really pride ourselves on that. But that comes with not just our physical location, but we've been attached to Kansas City and we owe our existence to the people of Kansas City, going back to the era of the Great War. Just after the armistice in 1918, Kansas Cityans raised the equivalent of about $40 million today in about 10 days to finance the building of the memorial, which at the time and to a lot of Kansas Cityans today will still be called the Liberty Memorial. We now call the National World War I Museum and Memorial. So we've had a consistent attachment to the town. When the building and the memorial itself was having some structural issues in the 80s and 90s, Kansas Cityans voted to impose a tax on themselves to help repair, restore, and then reopen the museum in 2006. So we're at the heart of the community. I'm super proud and excited to be a Kansas Cityan now and as part of that. And that goes with not only telling the story of Kansas Cityans in the World War, First World War, as well as everyone who served or was impacted by the Great War, but then also continuing to be a community center as much as a museum and memorial, whether we are a voting station, we have blood drives several times a year, we always welcome folks who want to use us as a communal space to discuss current issues, promote various topics within the community. So we really, one of our strong points is keeping connected with the community, and we owe everything we have to the community of Kansas City.
You know, I think one of my favorite parts of visiting the museum and the memorial, obviously, is going up to the memorial itself and looking at the large murals that are in one of those buildings there on the memorial ground with all of the leaders, with General Pershing and Ferdinand Foch and all of the Allied leaders. That's one of the most memorable parts for me in visiting the museum, apart from actually going into the museum space from, the ticketing area as you're crossing this glass bridge just up above a field of red poppies, which, 10 plus years later is still the second most memorable part of visiting the museum and memorial.
Every time I walk into work, whether it's driving up the U-shaped drive towards the front of the building and seeing the tower, just walking in and seeing the glass bridge, I do have to kind of pinch myself, remind myself that I work here, because there isn't an aspect of the building and the grounds that isn't gorgeous. Because we sit on about 48 acres of Kansas City parkland, and every inch of it is beautiful inside and out. The painting you're talking about, the Pantheon de la Guerre, it's one of my favorite objects in our collection, one of my favorite pieces of art, I think, that I can think of, just the story behind it, the fact that it was started painting the subjects when the war had just started and was painted through the war, and how it was changed later on in the 50s when it was restored here in Kansas City to reflect more of the Cold War attitudes of the time. It's just fantastic piece of art history, and I highly encourage, although it's up in the two galleries that are now above the main gallery, it's so important for folks to see. This is just such an aesthetically pleasing space, whether you don't have to be a history nerd to enjoy this museum, because there's just so much great architecture and art, and just to use a millennial term, the vibe is really good for being a war museum.
So collections connect us to history. They're so powerful. You just mentioned you have a favorite piece. What are some of your other favorites? Can you tell us about your favorite children in the collection?
Yeah, so there's quite a few, and it is very hard for me to pick out a few, but generally the ones that I try to use as a member of the education department and on the education team are the ones that connect us most to ways we experience the world we live in today. There is an amazing piece of French propaganda, which is a piece of toilet paper with Kaiser Wilhelm's face on it. And I remember as a young man, just in the years after 9/11, seeing similar items with Osama bin Laden. I still remember my parents being like, that's ridiculous. But it's not the first time that happened. There is so much history connecting to itself. We have a great set of artifacts up right now as well that help tell this sort of blurred line story of the Great War. It's from a soldier named Nicholson, who was from what was at the time a German owned part of now Denmark. So he was Danish, but had been conscripted into the German army, fought on the Western Front when he was on leave at home, decided it's time for me to get out of here, deserted, crossed the border into Denmark. When he was there, left his uniform and his rifle, and then got on a ship and immigrated to Connecticut. Well, during World War I, you didn't have to be a U.S. citizen to be drafted. So he immediately returns to Europe in 1918 with the United States Army, serves, and after the war goes and visits his relatives, gets his old German uniform and rifle and brings them back. So we have his U.S. uniform right next to his German uniform, also in the collection. And so there's just some amazing pieces. Our Renault tank, which was a tank operated by the French and Americans. So an example we have was driven by a French crew in support of American soldiers during the Meuse-Argonne Offensive, which is the largest and bloodiest battle the United States has ever fought. Not a lot of people remember it today. And it was knocked out, and you could actually see the hole where the German shell hit it. It still has its original paint, most of its original parts, and it's just a gorgeous piece that kind of brings home the weird transformational technological age that the Great War occurred in. So there's too many things to list, but those are just the top ones that I walk by today.
So I have to agree with one. I got to visit the museum in like 2009, I think, right after the opening. And walking in over that bridge on the poppies was just, it was poignant. It was amazing. And as we've seen, you know, as the anniversary, the 100th anniversary of the U.S. entry into World War One and other countries' entry into World War One, because I follow more than just U.S. museums online, the poppy has been a universal symbol of World War One and what happened in the veterans. Do you know where that symbolism came from? Could you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, definitely. And I'll let you know, any visitor who comes to the museum, we've got small cards that help explain it as well. And it is varied. In the English-speaking world, the poppy starts as a symbol of remembrance for the Great War, mainly based off of a poem written by a Canadian doctor serving at the front of the Canadian Army named John McCrae. In 1915, he's serving outside of Ypres, which is Y-P-R-E-S, in Belgium. One of his very close friends is killed by a shell, and he kind of sits down at his medical station and writes this poem, which is called In Flanders Fields. And I think a lot of folks might remember it from their English classes. In Flanders Fields, the poppies grow between the crosses row on row that mark our place, while in the sky larks still sing fly, so on. And that poem, which was ended up published not by McCrae, but by some of his friends who sent it on to be published in a magazine in England, became an incredibly important symbol for remembrance of the First World War. Those blood red Flanders poppies, as compared to the red and yellow California poppies, which people often ask us. We use Belgian blood red poppies from Flanders when we represent the Great War. And to the point that when the U.S. gets in the war, there's actually poems written in response saying, oh, we're coming over to help and avenge those who've died. So in the United Kingdom, the whole of what was the British Empire, British Commonwealth, as well as in the United States, poppies become that symbol of remembrance. They've grown to be remembrances of people who died in all wars, particularly still, again, in the British Empire and Commonwealth. And in the United States, it's kind of fallen away. You used to always see groups like the American Legion or the Veterans of Foreign Wars selling poppies around Veterans Day. And I think that's primarily because President Eisenhower made it Veterans Day versus just Armistice Day, remembering the dead of the Great War. And in the United States, we already had an existing holiday to remember the dead of war in Memorial Day in May. So while other nations see World War I as this horrible, bloody time, we are still really connected to that Memorial Day. If you go to France, they use the Bleuet de France, which is a blue cornflower, and is representative of the French soldiers who died. There's sunflowers and other yellow flowers in Belgium, into Germany, but especially in the English-speaking world, the poppy has stood for this remembrance of the Great War, and that's why it holds such an important place for us here in the museum.
You know, I work at a military museum. We focus on military veterans from Wyoming, the state of Wyoming. So I've worked quite a bit with our World War One collections. So I came in right at the centennial of the end of the war in 2018. But you know, I've had a great love of World War One and later the Korean conflict because of, you know, they get overshadowed by so much of what comes before or comes after. But what do you think are some of the key takeaways that you try and teach the community about the importance of the First World War?
Well, starting off, I think the most important thing is how much it affects the world we live in today, and not just these grand political aspects, but even in small things. You know, here in the Midwest, I'm from Michigan originally, and living in Kansas City, I have yet to get the word buddy out of my vocabulary. I use it way too often. And that's a doughboy word. The doughboys were the nickname for the U.S. soldiers serving in the war. They most likely picked it up from Welsh troops in the British Army they encountered, which used the Welsh term butty, which kind of just means unknown friend. Like, I don't know you, but what's it like up there? You know, is it bad up at the front where we're going, buddy? And that came back and kind of permeated into American culture. So, like, there's these small things, even phrases like, if you want to give everything your best, give them the whole 9 yards. Because a machine gun belt was 9 yards long. So they give them all the full nine yards was to fire off all of your ammunition. So small things then back up to these huge things. You know, the lasting impact from the fall and dividing of the Ottoman Empire and the Sykes-Picot Treaty, creating the boundaries of the modern Middle East, not based on any sort of ethnic or national identities, is something we are still dealing with today. Down to, you know, current conflicts in the Ukraine. You see the Ukrainian independence movement coming out of the First World War. You see the idea of pan-Slavic ideals, which come out of Russia during the Tsarist regime that falls at the end of the First World War and the establishment of the Soviet Union. So there's a lot of different topics to get into. The people who are the leaders of the Second World War in the United States, the people who are the leaders of the civil rights movement in the 50s and 60s in the United States, are the 20-somethings who are in the front in World War One. You know, whether that be in the military, in the factories, in the political movements, suffragettes, civil rights leaders, politicians. These are all folks who are learning how to operate and how to get things done in the circumstances of the Great War. So I think, apart from being a forgotten period from a military history perspective, from a civic perspective, it's also so important that we understand that, for example, Martin Luther King is inevitably connected with W.E.B. Du Bois, who's writing during the Great War and encouraging African-American participation in the American war effort. So there's a really strong connection, and it's important to note that Rosie the Riveter of World War II, she had a mother who got her the right to vote based on her activities and her protests and the pushing for suffragism, as well as establishing the right to work in factories to show that women could handle the load that inevitably falls on them during the Second World War. There's so many lessons to take from this era and place it into anything that comes afterwards. And it's a bar game that the staff and I, we all play here at the museum, is to mention anything in the world, and you can find a connection to World War One. And that's why I think it's just so important.
So kind of piggybacking off of that question about education, a lot of the museums that we've talked to in past episodes have been smaller museums with smaller staff. And so I'm interested in asking, with the education team, how did you guys pivot during COVID to be accessible to people during that time period? It was harder for a lot of smaller museums to do the pivot, but I know that the educational outreach at somewhere like you, at your museum, at all museums, but, you know, specifically at your museum, is probably vital to a lot of curriculum across the U.S. for school children. So how has that changed? And is it something that's for the better?
Yeah. Well, and I want to start off answering this by saying that I joined our team in June of 2021. So all of the groundwork and really most of the work in general that I'm about to take credit for was actually done by Laura Vogue, who is our curator of education, as well as my other education team members, Haley Sheriff and Cherie Kelly. So I want to make sure they get that shout out as well. And it has changed quite a bit, both for schools and then for the general public. We, like most museums, we live and breathe and really anticipate and love getting schools in. And so having that ability to connect through to students as well as to teachers through teacher trainings, through we recently had a National Endowment for the Humanities seminar on the First World War in the Middle East, which was for teachers in person, but also is available online for the general public to watch, is something that we have really learned to develop over the pandemic era. As a group that studies a time period where there was also a very horrible pandemic, we have tried to take some of those lessons to heart as well. Unfortunately for museums in 1918, platforms like YouTube didn't exist. And for us, we're a lot of our public programs at the end of the day are lectures, they're presentations by the leading scholars, leading experts, people who are actively engaged in teaching or learning about the First World War era, come onto our stage, speak, and it goes right onto YouTube. At the same time, we've found a lot of success with some of the Zoom lectures we've conducted. And we've created a lot of series that have really resonated with various groups. World War One Changed Us is a series you can watch. And the title kind of speaks for itself, is we take a topic and see how World War One changed us. A great kind of experiment we did with that one recently was we did a non-English language one. We did World War One Changed Us about Puerto Rico with Dr. Harry Frankie Rivera, who's in New York. And we did the first one in English and the second one in Spanish. And the ability to reach those new audiences who might be interested, might not be able otherwise to reach us. We've also had Mrs. Wilson's Knitting Circle, which is based on the fact that President Wilson's wife, the First Lady, Mrs. Wilson, had a knitting circle where they knit items for soldiers and other workers at the front. And we've kind of taken that handicrafts attitude and followed that. And it's great because I'll sit there and I'll do some sewing or some knitting. And then listen to a presenter talk about, it doesn't have to be material culture, but it very often falls on those minute things that have to deal with the Great War. We've had an amazing scholar from Belgium talk about how the Belgian silk industry benefited from the war and how American philanthropy saved the Belgian tapestry industry during the Great War as it was trying to be evacuated and saved from war-torn Belgium. We've had folks talk about female spies and suffragettes, the suffragette movement among Central Powers nations in Germany and Austria-Hungary. And so there's just a wide array of things that, from a museum guest perspective, you're able to watch it if you're sitting on your couch in Alaska. And hopefully someday you'll come to Kansas City. And we've seen success because with all the modern technology, we can see where folks are watching from. And we love to know when you join us online where you're watching from. So we've had regular attendees to our programs from Japan and India and South Africa and Israel and the UK and Canada. So we're helping bring in that international audience because our content is international. As well, from a museum worker perspective, it's a lot easier to set up a Zoom call than to organize the stage and fly in a speaker from Europe or from somewhere in the United States and get all of our staff who run all of our AV on site. So there's a real strong benefit to that, and it's evergreen. If you go onto our YouTube page right now, the National World War I Museum Memorial, you'll see all the lectures we conduct. They're all available for free. You can search a topic that you're interested in. And a lot of times we'll even link to the book that the author is selling or promoting so you can learn more. And so it's been a really great way to stay connected with the community and keep it evergreen. We love getting folks on site, but at the same time, we want to make sure that everybody who can possibly be engaged with the First World War, no matter where in the world they are, gets that opportunity.
So can people find more information if they want to go to lectures as they're happening on your website?
Yes, absolutely. If you go to www.theworldwar.org, you'll be able to find our events page. And not only our lectures, we've got a lot of other interesting programs, including living history events. We have events talking about a wide range of objects, of course, lectures, but also an in-person Mrs. Wilson's, where we highly encourage anybody to bring their knitting or other handiwork as we discuss actually the current collections with our director of our registrar, Stacey Peterson. And if you head over to our website, feel free to check it out. Also, if you again to our YouTube channel, www.youtube.com/theworldwar, you'll be able to find out quite a bit more.
Okay, wait, back up. Stacey Peterson, did she go to Texas Tech?
I believe she did.
I know her. That's awesome. Well, Stacey, Patty says hi.
I'll let her know.
We went to college together.
Oh. It's such a small museum world.
It is. There's always an interesting level of, how do I know this person? I know this person, but how?
Seven degrees of separation.
Yeah, it's or the 7 degrees of Kevin Bacon, if you want to play that game. But no, it's, you know, one of my funny memories of visiting the museum and memorial was looking around for a picture of Harry Truman. I figured, oh, it's Kansas City. You know, obviously, you know, Independence is a suburb. You know, Harry Truman is, you know, that area of Missouri's famous, you know, most famous son. And it took me about half an hour to find him. And he was off to a side, and it was part of a company photo, or sorry, a battery photo of his guard unit. And I thought, I must be really bad if I it took me that long to find a picture of Harry Truman.
We, you know, that's one of our favorite games. Is the photograph is a panoramic yard long, which was a very common type of group photography at the time. And it's in a whole wall of them, and we have a magnifying glass so you can move up and down to inspect them. And yeah, in that photograph of Battery D of the 129th Field Artillery is their battery commander, Captain Harry Truman. And you know, it goes back to part of the strong connections with World War I in Kansas City. They are still to this day one of our local National Guard units, still based out of Independence. In fact, every Memorial Day, they as part of the 1812 Overture, show up and fire cannons on the North Lawn. So still very connected with the city and the museum and memorial. And yeah, no, that's some of those small things that I love, just that we are able to slip in and show that these huge figures, which, you know, as I like to say, the folks who have huge Wikipedia pages are just as intertwined with the folks who don't have Wikipedia pages. During this time, and it is just a really fascinating way of showing, hey, here's this young guy who's going through his formative years during the Great War and is going to end up doing some amazing things 30, 40 years later.
Well, James, thanks for joining us today. I think we're going to wind up this episode, but thank you very much for taking time to share more about your museum journey and about the National World War I Museum and Memorial.
Yeah, anytime. It was such a great pleasure being on, and I can't wait to hear from more folks in the field. A rising tide raises all ships. So.
Couldn't agree with you more. So with that, we'll close out this edition of the M-Files. For all of our listeners, please remember that new episodes will be dropping every 2 weeks. These episodes, along with others from our previous seasons, are available on most podcasting platforms, including Apple Podcast and Spotify. All of them are available on our website. When you have a chance, please take a minute to rate and review the M-Files wherever you are listening to us. Your reviews help others find our show and let other people know what we're doing. In between episodes, join us on Facebook at the M-Files Podcast as we keep the conversation going about the museum world. You can email us directly at themfilespodcast@gmail.com. Check the show notes for this episode for links to our social media and website. Thanks again, and we'll see you again next time.